Recorded live in the Phantasmo Lounge, high atop the Dick Cutler Building in beautiful Midtown Portsmouth, Virginia, it's Phantasmo After Dark with your host, Rob Floyd. Tonight's topic, the hideous sun demon. Well, hey, everybody. Welcome back to the old podcast here. We've been off schedule for a while with all the craziness and events and things in October and then various illnesses and real-life stuff going on, but hopefully we'll get back on track here. Got a few events coming up if you're in the area here locally in Tidewater, Virginia, coming up on December 5th at the Chesapeake Central Library's Phantasmo Cult Cinema Explosion, a double-feature cult movie night that we host. And this time, as our Christmas edition, we're hosting the remake of Black Christmas and the original Silent Night, Deadly Night. And that's free. Both movies up on the big screen. So come on out and see that if you get a chance. And then a week later on December 15th. No, I'm sorry. Wait a minute. That's December 9th. The Phantasmo. Saturday, December 9th. On December 15th at the Narrow Expanded Cinema, Flick It Fridays, I'll be hosting a showing of Time Bandits. And that should be a lot of fun. See that up on the big screen. If you've never seen it, perfect opportunity to come do it. Classic old restored historic theater in downtown Norfolk, and Time Bandits, Terry Gilliam directed. Strange movie, but a lot of fun. So join us, won't you? Now, all that out of the way, I guess we can get back on to tonight's topic. And it's just me and you here tonight. No co-host, as sometimes we are want to do or have to do just because circumstances and schedules don't allow, but that's okay. So this will probably be a short one, but we're going to talk about a kind of a fun movie. And if you know me, you know, among the many things that I like, I have a fondness for the 50s atomic age sci-fi horror movies. They're a lot of fun. Some of them are kind of goofy, taken into context of when they were made and the time and everything, but they're a lot of fun, most of them. And this is one of my favorites, The Hideous Sun Demon. I say it's unusual, but it's not unusual at the same time. It's interesting that it wasn't made by one of the major studios. It was an independent film made by the star of the film, Robert Clark, who also co-wrote it and directed it and starred in it. He was in a film, he was in quite a few films over the years, a lot of TV in the 60s, 70s, and the 80s. A lot of films. Most notably, he had a part in Man from Planet X and The Astounding She-Monster. After making that film, which actually wasn't a great film, but made a lot of money when it came out, he thought it would be pretty easy to make a genre-type film and make a lot of money. And the two biggest genres at the time that were making money in the late 50s there were Westerns and sci-fi or horror pictures. So he decided to make a sci-fi movie, or horror movie, depending on how you look at it. And he got together with a friend of his, and they decided what they were going to write about it, the script. So it's basically, they took the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde story and just updated it, changed it, made it an atomic age story. And they make no bones about it, that they pretty much paid tribute to, instead of ripping off, Jekyll and Hyde. But Robert Clark, in an interview, actually says that. He quotes that when he was a young kid, he snuck out of the house and to go up the street to the movie theater to see the Frederick March, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which is probably one of the best versions of Jekyll and Hyde out there. And I believe we did a podcast on that a while back. So go back and check that one out. But that movie stuck with him over the years and made a big impression on him as a kid. So he decided to take that story and do his own version of it here with the hideous sun demon. And it does parallel it in a lot of ways. He has of course, he's the dual personality where he's the good scientist for the most part. And then he turns into the monster, the evil monster that kills. And he has the good girlfriend when he's the scientist. And then when he's starting to lose his mind or whatever, not quite the monster yet, but on the other side, he has the bad girlfriend from the other side of the tracks. And it is a little risque for the time, I think, anyway, for the late 50s. Just like the Frederick March Jekyll and Hyde pre-code film there was a bit risque for its time in some of the scenes. And, you know, you'll see them. Watch the movie and you'll see what I mean. It's nothing spectacular. No nudity or anything. Not in the 50s, that's for sure. But the way the scene is played that I'm talking about, where they're on the beach and they're flirting together and they start making out, and the way it's shot and the way it's played, it's a little spicy for the 50s. But let's back up a little bit. Let's go over the plot real quick. Basic sci-fi plot. And it starts off, boom, right out of the gate. As soon as the title comes on the screen, which the title's great. It's a great comic, jagged, you know, horror font, catches your eye real big on the screen. And then it goes right into the first scene is on a alarm going off at the atomic research facility. And then some guys are carrying somebody out on a stretcher and putting them in an ambulance and taking them to the hospital. So right off the bat, boom, it starts with what's happened to him. You don't get any setup. You don't get any long, drawn-out character development of who he is or anything, because you don't need it. You know, you want to see the monster. But it starts off right like that, and it keeps moving at a pretty good clip throughout the whole movie. It doesn't really slow down, I don't think. I think it moves along pretty good. I've watched it a few times. He gets to the hospital, and there's a great scene where they pull him into the admitting, and it looks like either they've sprayed him with water or they got a little glitter on his face or something to make him kind of sparkle, because he's supposed to have been bathed in radiation, and that's why they're bringing him in. And a cheap effect, but it gets the point across. It doesn't look too hokey. And then I guess he recovers over a little bit over the couple days, and they're going to let him go sit out in the sun to get some sun, get some air, and because he's feeling good. They can't really find anything wrong with him, but he has been bathed in this radiation, so they are, keeping an eye on him. After he sits out in the sun for a few minutes, he turns into the monster in kind of a reptile-ish creature with scales and fangs. And it's kind of cool because you don't really see it at first. You see the reaction of the woman sitting beside him when she sees him. And then you see the back of him. He runs into the hospital. And he finally gets into a room and you see his hands. And his hands are all scaly. And then you get a quick shot of his face in the mirror and he smashes the mirror. It's cool. I wouldn't have shown his face that long if it was me. I think they show it just a little too long, but they don't linger on it. So it's okay. So you get a little taste of that real quick. Right at the beginning to keep you going. And then a scientist explains to his friends, his girlfriend and his other scientist friend, what's happened to him or what they think has happened to him, that the radiation has caused him to de-evolve back to a more primitive state, more of a reptile like state. And they go into that more. You'll watch the film and get all that scientific double talk. But it's cool. It's the way they explain it. At least they're trying to explain it in a scientific way. So he's well enough to leave, but they still want to keep an eye on him, and he wants to just get away from everybody. So he leaves at night and goes and settles into this beautiful home out near the beach somewhere, a huge place. You'd think he was going to a cabin, but he gets there. It's this big house. And you get the idea of passage of time. It's not done that well. But they tell you how long, he's been there for days, weeks, months, or whatever. And he just goes out at night because he can't go out during the day. He'll turn into the sun demon. Anyway, he goes out one night driving and gets some gas and then goes into this bar to get some cigarettes and ends up seeing this girl singing in the bar at the piano. And, of course, he starts to fall for her a bit because she's, a good-looking girl. And she's singing and he's in a bar and he's lonely and they start having a drink and start talking, and her gangster boyfriend comes up and isn't having any of that, so they get in a little bit of a fight. He ends up punching the gangster out and taking the girl, and they go for a drive. First mistake. And they end up at the beach. And this is a weird scene. Well, one, it's a lot of day for night shooting like they did in a lot of these films back then, and some scenes it works okay, and some scenes it doesn't work that good in because, ooh, that's a bright moon. but you can get past that in this and get wrapped up in the story here. But this scene where they're at the beach, it starts off, they pull up to the beach, they have a little drink, he has a flask there, then they get out and take a walk, and they're down by the water, and they start making out and start kissing, and apparently he gets a little too aggressive. And she tries to push herself away, and he's trying to keep her there, and she pushes away and falls in the water, and then they both start laughing, and he picks her up, and they start to walk away like it was okay. Like, they totally forget that he was being real aggressive, and she was trying to get away. it's a little uneven right there. But the way the scene plays when they walk away and he builds a little bonfire to, I guess, dry her clothes, and she's putting a blanket around her. And this is a kind of a risque scene for that time, I think. If you take into context of when the film was made and what other films were like and the code and all that at the time. But then again, it's an independent film. It wasn't a studio film. And it definitely wasn't a union picture. So, you know, there's all that going for it. The scene plays out and leads you to believe that they got together that evening. We'll leave it at that. And the next morning, the sun's peeking out and he wakes up on the beach. He had fallen asleep and he panics, runs to his car, gets in his car, won't start. Finally, it starts. He takes off and she's trying to run after him and he's just gone. He changes along the way. Now, you don't really see the chain. You don't get any transformation scenes. You get towards the very end. We'll talk about that in a minute. But he pulls up at the house, and he's already changed. And he jumps out of his car and jumps over a fence and goes up a little hill to the house. And the girlfriend scientist from the beginning of the movie has come to get him because they have found another scientist who was an expert in atomic mutation or radiation who's going to try and help him. So she's come, and she just sees him from the back running, and he runs and hides in a shed. And by the time she gets herself around there to the shed and opens the door where it's dark, it's a nice little suspense the way this scene is shot, actually, her going to the door, and you see the camera getting closer to the door, her point of view, and she opens the door, and you're expecting the sun demon, and it's him. He's changed back, and he's kind of cowering in a fetal position in the corner. And the movie goes on. The scientist finally comes, and they try to help him and say, okay, well, we'll try to get you to the hospital in the next couple of days. Just stay here. Don't go out. And, of course, he ends up going out, and he goes back to that bar to get a drink. And it's like he's forgotten what had happened the night before because he goes back to the same bar, and he's not looking for the girl and, I guess, not expecting to see her. And, of course, she works there, so she's there, and she's pissed because he left her at the beach. She had to hitchhike back, and the gangster's pissed. Her boyfriend, because she went with him, and pissed at the guy because he left her. So they end up having a confrontation and beating the crap out of him, taking him outside and beating the crap out of him. And the girl feels sorry, so she says she's going to take him to hospital, ends up taking him back to her house. He wakes up at her house, and they flirt a little bit more. Then the gangster comes over and asks him to step outside, and he doesn't want to go out in the sun. And the gangster has a gun, makes him go, and of course he changes, kills the gangster, and then takes off running through the woods and everything. The rest of the movie is basically him being chased. He goes back to the house, turns back. Scientists, his friends are there, and his girlfriend and the other guy's there. And then the police come after him, and, of course, he runs away. There's another scene, what I call the Frankenstein scene, where he's hiding in this shack near the oil fields. And this little girl that lives near there befriends him and offers to bring him some food, and of course her mother finds out that her new friend is this guy, and of course it's all over the radio that this maniac killer that's running loose. So the mother freaks out, and of course he runs away. Now this is where, right here, you get almost a transformation scene, and I gotta hand it to them the way they did this, because, you know, they had no budget to do this movie. It was really, I think the budget was like $50,000, which is nothing. Today, that would barely cover catering or transportation on a movie. But let me set this up a little bit first. The monster suit is it's a mask and a torso piece, a shirt piece and hands. And he wears slacks. And a lot of times he wears a shirt over the top part. So the suit, the monster suit, I believe, cost $500 out of the budget for that. It's a good-looking suit. I mean, you can see where the mask, the top of the mask attaches to the chest and the flap flops a lot. But, you know, hey, you just get past that and enjoy it. It's a good-looking monster, I think. A lot of scales all over it. And the top was actually a wetsuit that they had attached scales to. And apparently he sweat a lot in it. And there's a scene, or at least a still out there, where you can see the sweat had run down out of the suit into his slacks, and it looks like he wet himself. But this particular scene is really cool. The way they get by with kind of giving you a transformation without having the budget to do a transformation is they show him, you know, he's run out of the shack into the sun. He's fallen down the ground writhing. And they, you know, put some, I don't know, a little bit of makeup on his face, like, you know, cuts or sores or something. And then it cuts away to a cop running around looking for him. And then it cuts back to they've got the suit on him and have the mask on him, but they haven't put the fangs in under the mask. So you see his real mouth, and they haven't done all the makeup, and they haven't done all the makeup around his eyes. So you still have a little bit of the human look around with the eyes and the mouth, but you have the scale. It was kind of, I think it's ingenious the way they did it. Really, it works, because you only see it for like a second, and then it cuts back to the cop running around, and it cuts back to the full made-up mask with the makeup and the fangs and everything. And it was brilliant, because you think you're seeing more than you're seeing. You think you're seeing a transformation, and you're really not, but it worked. That's one of my favorite parts of the movie. Now, and from here on, it's just him running and the cop chasing him. And they get to this big oil, gas, tanker thing, where, like they have in all these movies, where they have to run up some kind of scaffolding to get on top of this big this big thing and have a little shootout. And because, you know, this is an atomic age picture and it's a scientific monster, not a supernatural, pretty much anything will kill it. Bullets. So this cop shoots him a few times. He falls down. He gets back up. They fight a little bit more. And the cop shoots him a couple more times, and he falls off the tanker and hits the ground. And the cool thing is he doesn't transform back because he's still in the sun. So he dies as the monster there on the ground. The last line of the film is horrible. I can't remember it exactly right now, but the older scientist says to the girl, don't cry. Well, maybe you should cry. And then something about, we can only hope that he's at peace now, or something like that. But it's horribly delivered and horribly written. But that aside, I really do like this movie, and I'll watch it over and over because it is unusual. It's one of those that came out this time, and it doesn't quite follow the same formula that a lot of them. If you watch, I did a podcast a while back on teenage monster movies, like Teenage Frankenstein, Teenage Wolfman, Blood of Dracula, How to Make a Monster, and they all have this formula they follow, and they came out in the 50s, and you can kind of count on them doing what they're going to do, and they're enjoyable and they're fun. This one doesn't quite go that way, and which makes it fun in a different way, and the low budgetness of it sometimes really shows and sometimes doesn't. The sound is a little weird and a little hollow in some places because low budget. But it doesn't detract it, and it's not bad. It doesn't take away from it. And the acting in some scenes is really good and natural in some of the characters. In some, it's a little stiff, and you can tell that they're not really professional actors. Now, some of them are, but some of them are not. And that's another interesting thing about this. Robert Clark wanted to make this film, so most of the people that worked on it were film students from the University of Southern California, where I think he was actually taking some classes on script writing or something at the time. And he got some of the film students there interested in there. One of them invested in the film, and a lot of the others worked on the film with him. And some of them acted in the film, and a few of the other people that were acted are like his relatives and in-laws and things were played some of the different parts, and his nieces and nephews. In fact, I think the little girl that befriends him in the scene is his sister's kid, and then the little boy who's extra, the newspaper boy, is a nephew of his or something like that. His father-in-law, I think, is one of the scientists or something, and his mother-in-law is the lady at the beginning that he's sitting out in the sun with and sees the first transformation. So that's kind of cool. They shot this film on weekends, and for a couple of reasons. One, because they could get 2 days rental of all the camera equipment for one day's fee. They rent it for Saturday, and you get it for Saturday and Sunday, because everything used to be closed on Sundays, so they couldn't get it back till Monday. So they get 2 days rental for one day's price. That, and everybody was working during the week. Robert Clark was working. He had parts in other films he was filming during the week. And the film students were going to school during the week, so the only time they could film it was on weekends. So I can't remember. It was like over 12 weekends, I think, is what it was that they shot this picture for a budget of $50,000. And when it came out, it really didn't make a whole lot of money, from what I understand. Not like he had wanted it to or thought it would. Didn't make Astounding She-Monster money. But he did, and he didn't have a distribution deal either. I think he self-distributed it first, and then he got hooked up with a company, and it got on a double bill with Attack of the Crab Monsters on the drive-in circuit. And he did play on the driving circuit. That was at first. And that was, of course, all these movies did back then. And he went to the premiere, him and I think the producer or co-director that he had with him, went to the first couple of showings of it and, did interviews at the drive-in. And at one of them, I think it was at the premiere. This is a neat story. How cool would this have been to be there? After they got introduced, they did the interview, and then the movie started. He snuck away, put on the Sun Demon costume, and ran around in between the cars scaring people. That would be awesome to see. Another thing like that that would have been incredible. Oh, a while back, I got to meet Dick Warlock, who played Michael Myers in Halloween 2. And in part of the first Halloween, but he played Michael Myers in all of Halloween 2. And Dick is a great guy. Fun, good sense of humor, fun to be around. He and his wife, Kat, both really nice people. And he's just a neat guy to talk to. Has had an incredible career. He was a stuntman for a great many years. Did all of Kurt Russell's stunts in most of his movies, from the Disney movies up through Escape from New York, Big Trouble in Little China. But cut this tangent short. Where I'm going with that is when after the wrap of Halloween 2, he kept one of the masks and the jumpsuit and the scalpel and the knife. And he had those for a lot of years. But he and his wife, Kat, they went to see Halloween 2, I think, at a drive-in after it came out. And he did the same thing. He put on the mask and the jumpsuit and started walking around and scaring some people, getting a kick out of it. But nobody knew that it was the actual guy from the movie. He just did it because it was fun to do. And how awesome would that have been to be there and to see that and to know? Oh, God, I can't even imagine. That's so cool. But Robert Clark did the same thing with Hideous Sun Demon. And that would have been amazing to see. I think the original mask still exists. I guess the rest of the suit is gone. I'm not sure. But the original mask is in the Hideous Sun Demon. It's in the collection of Bob Burns. And if you don't know who Bob Burns is, look him up. He's the next generation Forry Ackerman. He's got an amazing collection of original sci-fi horror monster memorabilia from the movies. And he's out in California, and as far as I know, he still lets people tour his home and look at the stuff. The movie itself, I think, is still available. Pretty easy to get if you go on Amazon. I don't know what it's going for right now. I haven't looked it up. I think Image Entertainment or Retro Media, one of those companies, is the copy that I have. I got quite a few years ago on DVD. It should be pretty easy to find at Amazon or eBay. I don't know. It might even be on YouTube. I haven't even checked that out. Here's something interesting. I want to say it was the 80s, sometime in the 80s, they did MST3K has done Hideous Sun Demon, I believe. But I want to say it was the 80s, it might have been the 90s, but I think it was in the 80s. Some guys got together and redubbed the Hideous Sun Demon with Robert Clark's permission, actually. And it's called it What's Up Hideous Sun Demon. Kind of like What's Up Tiger Lily, Woody Allen did. I haven't seen this yet, and I would love to see this because apparently Jay Leno did the voice of Robert Clark, the lead character. And Cam Clark, Robert Clark's son, who's a voiceover actor apparently, did some other voices in it. And it has Robert Clark's approval for them to do it. So that's something to look out for. I don't know if that's available or not, but I think I'm going to have to try to find that. And I do want to see Astounding She-Monster too, since that was the movie he was in that sparked his idea to make Hideous Sun Demon. I believe that's still available too. I was reading somewhere, doing some research on this, and somebody was saying that this also is a kind of a remake of The Wolfman or a sci-fi take of The Wolfman. And I kind of see what they were saying, or a reverse Wolfman, where he turns into the monster during the day instead of at night, the sun turns him into the moon. But I got to go with more of Robert Clark's vision that it's a take on Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It has more parallels to that. I was kind of thinking, kind of reminded me too, at the very beginning, where it just starts off, boom, with the alarm going off and the tragedy's already happened. Incredible Melting Man starts off like that, if I remember correctly, and just goes boom right into the story and doesn't stop and keeps going. This moves along actually at a quicker clip, a quicker pace than Incredible Melting Man. And as much fun as that movie is, it is a little slow in parts and all, but and this one's a lot more fun. And especially, like I said, if you like the 1950s atomic age stuff like I do, this is one you need to put on your list to see. It doesn't get mentioned as much and doesn't get seen as much, I don't think, because it wasn't a studio picture, I guess, as most of the other stuff that you hear about, like It Conquered the World or Deadly Mantis or the Teenage Monster movies or, you know, It Came from Outer Space, I Married a Monster. It doesn't get mentioned in the same breath as those movies for some reason. And it really should, because it fits right in. It's a great-looking monster. It looks right at home alongside any of the other ones. And like I said, the movie's not bad. It's not great, but it's not bad. It's well worth a watch. And I would highly recommend seeking this out if you get a chance. Compare it to some of the other movies that came out at the time. See what you think. And like I said, some of the scenes play really well, and some of them are a little stilted, a little stiff. There's a few scenes in it that are the type of scenes when you see people make fun of 50s movies, that's what they're making fun of, is that right there. But the rest of it is pretty good. Two thumbs up, definitely. And I think that's about all I've got for this one. No need to go rambling on and on with just me here and you. And I thank you for being here. And hopefully we'll have some guest hosts, some special guests coming back soon. And we'll be back on schedule with our regular bi-weekly podcast here. And if you have any suggestions or any comments, please, by all means, drop us a line at phantasmoad@gmail.com. That's phantasmode, all one word, @gmail.com. Or throw down a comment or two on the Facebook page at Phantasmo After Dark on Facebook. You know, let us know what you like, what you don't like, if you want to shut the hell up. You got some suggestions? We'd love to hear from you. It's nice to know that somebody's listening out there. And as always, up on the Facebook page there, I will be posting some pictures from this film, maybe some behind the scenes if I can find them, trailer, any interesting bits I can find, I'll put in, throw in an album, picture album there on the page. And that's about it. So, hey, thanks for listening, everybody. And till next time, good night.